Welcome to Steppin' Out, the 12-step meeting on the air. Tonight you'll meet real people with true stories of addiction and recovery. And now, Steppin' Out.
Hello and welcome to America's 12-step radio show. My name is Drew and this is Steppin' Out. The stories you're about to hear are real. It's a 12-step meeting on the air, so kick back, grab a cup of coffee, and listen in, because if you ever wondered what went on inside those 12-step meetings but were afraid to ask, you are going to find out right now. Guests are here from Alcoholics Anonymous to share with us their experience, strength, and hope. And first up, we have Angel. Angel, how you doing, man?
Hello, Drew. How are you?
Good.
I'm Angel, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Welcome, Angel. And listen, man, tell me a little bit about what it was like and what it's like now.
Okay, well, Drew, my story started a long time ago, back in 1950-something.
Wow.
And back then, I remember that alcohol was a part of the American way of living. You know, there was alcohol in my family, and my father drank, and he always had his cousins and his relatives at the house.
Sure. How old were you back then?
Well, I must have been 3 or 4 years old.
A little guy,
yeah. Yeah, very, very young. And they would drink, and, you know, towards the end of the night, they had a lot of arguments and stuff like that, but everybody went to work the next day, and it was normal. You know, my father had this little bar set up at the corner of the house, and that was the way life was. You know, every weekend they would get together and they would drink. And of course, you know, us kids would sit around and watch them as they were drinking, and as we noticed that they were getting a little drunker, then we would be able to grab a little drink and sip it, you know, without them seeing us. And I think that's where it all started for me. I think I took that first drink when I was about 5 years old. And I don't know what happened. I know I got drunk.
Do you remember the taste?
I remember the taste. I remember it was like, actually, it tasted like regular rubbing alcohol to me. Because, you know, I used to play around in the bathroom and, you know, touch all the medicine bottles. And I remember it tasting like that. It was hot, and it went down my throat, and it burned my stomach. And then the room started spinning, and I remember I passed out. And I puked a whole lot that day.
I bet.
And then after that, I remember I was I had hopes and dreams, you know, of becoming a rock and roll star. That was early 60s, and the Beatles were around, and one of my desires in life was to become a rock and roll star. And so I joined this little group of neighborhood kids, and we formed a little band, and we went around and played at some of the different high schools and grammar schools in the neighborhood. And I remember one night we were going to do a sixth grade graduation class, and I had woke up that morning with laryngitis from practicing the night before, and I had to do the show at 6 o'clock, and by 4:30, you know, my voice was still pretty hoarse, and so I went to, you know, I started thinking, what am I going to do? And I remember that my father used to give us a little spoonful of alcohol with honey and some lemon, you know, of some Bacardi.
Oh, okay.
Whenever we had a cold. And so I decided, well, maybe I could do that. So I went down in his cupboard and I grabbed a half a pint of Bacardi and I drank it. I drank half of it. And I was able to sing. I was able to sing that night. I got, you know, I felt great. I believe that I got a standing ovation. I don't know if that really happened or not. But I know that the show went off and it seemed like alcohol opened up a window of opportunity for me. That was something that just, you know, it catapulted me forward into, you know, my neighborhood. I grew up in Spanish Harlem, and prior to that drink, you know, I was a real shy kid. Nobody knew me. I was afraid. You know, I'd walk down the streets all by myself half of the time. And after that night, that drink, and that, you know, that singing opportunity that I had, it seemed like everybody in the neighborhood knew who I was.
Wow.
And everybody was pointing at me, and the girls were pointing at me, and so I felt like, you know, that this was my ticket to wherever it was that I was going the rest of my life.
So the Bacardi was magic.
The Bacardi was magic, and I began to, you know, become friends with people from other parts of the neighborhood, from two or three blocks down the street. And I don't know, alcohol took over for me from that moment on. It took over my life, and after that, I just drank every day. I looked for every opportunity to drink.
How quickly was the onset of it taking over your life?
It was quick. It was.
Give me some time. Give me a time frame. Like, was it a year? You know.
I drank that drink, Drew, and after that, I lost my desire to go to school, so I quit school.
And you were like, what, 16?
I was like, you know, maybe 15, 16 okay. years old. So
school's done. That's
school's
good.
Done. Okay. School was done, and I started hanging out on the streets in New York.
Okay.
And what I would do, we'd hang out, and we'd, you know, the first thing that we would ask each other in the morning was, you know, how much money do you have? And we would all gather our little, you know, money together,
gotcha.
And we would buy some alcohol. And once the alcohol was in us, then there was no, all bets were off. We didn't know what we were going to do. And of course, you know, we had to, you know, make money and you know, so that we could support ourselves.
How were you making money?
We were selling drugs, and we were stealing bicycles, and
okay.
we just didn't care. It seemed like once alcohol was in our system,
yeah.
there was no
all bets
ethics.
Were off.
All bets were off.
Yeah.
Everything was off, and we did whatever we had to do to continue to drink and to continue to do other things that we did. You know,
right.
And so that's how my life went. And then around the age of 16, and I had some warnings. I had some priests in my neighborhood who came over and threatened us and told us they would tell our parents.
What were they seeing that concerned them?
Well,
you were obviously asleep to this. You couldn't see, but in retrospect, there was obviously some concern there. What were the priests seeing that they were worried about?
They were starting to see us, get in trouble with the law. We were a lot of us were going to jail for, you know, theft,
okay.
And they were seeing our grades drop. You know, some of the ones who were some of the kids that were still in school, their grades were dropping.
Mm.
Just our overall behavior, you
yeah.
know, the way we behaved, because we were raised Catholics, and we were, you know, we had this upbringing, and they had watched us grow up, you know, all the way until we got, you know, right around just before high school, and then all of a sudden we just changed completely. All of us in my neighborhood, we all
wow.
changed, and so it took its toll on us, and they kind of threatened us and told us that if we didn't go seek help, that they were going to tell our parents. And of course, we went and we looked at the couple of places that had been offered, like Phoenix House and a few other programs that were just coming to bloom
mm-hmm.
in the 1960s. And I just couldn't accept that I had a problem. I was too young. I was only 16 years old.
Right.
And I just, you know, I said, well, I have time. I have time to stop, and I can stop any time that I want. And
Did you ever try to stop?
No.
No.
I really never believed that I had a problem at that time. I just, you know, I just said, this is just a phase, and I'm going to, you know, I'm
right.
going to stop this someday. So after a couple of years of that, and I started to get into more trouble as a result of my drinking, I ended up doing a stint in jail.
How long?
In prison. I did 4 years.
4 years. What, yeah. what did you get in trouble for?
Sales of narcotics.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of which were felonies, and so I ended up doing what they call a Rockefeller bid, which was for, you know, for, actually they were offering life, a
Oof.
Life sentence, but somehow I got to do this thing called a Rockefeller Zip 4 is what they call it.
Okay.
And they sent me away for 4 years in Rikers Island. And so I did my time. And
was there drinking in jail?
There was some drinking, and there was stuff like that in jail, but I, for some reason, I knew that I had to change my life. I knew that something had gone terribly wrong in my life, and I decided that I would, you know, go to school and, you know, try to get an education. So I did a lot of reading, and I did a lot of, I got my GED in Rikers Island, and studied a lot of psychology books and sociology books because I wanted to change my life.
Drugs gave you a 4-year bid in Rikers Island, and you were pretty much saying that might have been your moment of clarity, was it?
No.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Drew.
It was not your moment of clarity.
No,
okay.
It wasn't. It was a moment of probably just wanting to change.
Okay.
But not really actually believing that alcohol or drugs had anything to do with my problems. I used every excuse in the world. I used the fact that I was Puerto Rican and that I was poor and I was uneducated. I used everything in the world to try to, you know, rationalize what was going on in my life. But I did make that promise while I was in jail that I was not going to go back to the same thing. And it took me one day out in the streets before I was back at it.
You were drinking the first day?
I was drinking the first day, and before I knew it, I was back into the same routine and the same.
Were you selling drugs again?
I was selling drugs.
You didn't learn anything.
I didn't learn anything. I figured that if I got married and had a child, that that would change my life.
And did it.
So that's what
well,
I did.
Well, I'm sure it changed your life, but did it help you with your drinking and drug problem?
It didn't help at all. As a matter of fact, it created even more of an insanity in my life because now I wasn't even able to take care of my child or take care of the wife. And that was my life for the next 30 years. My life was about drinking and trying to be normal. I just wanted to be normal, but I didn't know how to be normal. And so long as I had alcohol in me and drugs in me, there wasn't a chance in hell that I would be normal. I did a lot of moving around. I moved from place to place, city to city. I moved from wife to wife, and I moved from job to job, thinking and hoping that someday, somehow, the right combination of a job and a wife and a child and buying a home and would somehow make me feel that I was okay and that I wouldn't need to drink. But I drank for 30 years.
Mm.
And finally, after 30 years of drinking and after just having lost, having been through a couple of divorces and having been through a couple, millions of job losses, I finally made this conscious decision to give up trying to quit and just going out and just getting this thing out of my system one way or another.
What did you do?
I just started to use and drink and not care about trying to fix my life. I just went out and tried to
went to hell with yourself,
yeah,
huh?
Basically, yeah. I just got up to use and to drink and didn't have any goals. I didn't have any dreams. I just drank and
wow.
I drank for about 7 or 8 years.
When that period started, how old were you?
The period of drinking?
Yeah. When you just said, forget it. I'm just going to go with this.
It was in 1987 that I attempted, to come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay.
But it was only, it was 7 years later that I reached, I couldn't get sober because I wasn't doing what I was asked to do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't accepting the program or my alcoholism. And 7 years after that, I made that determination that I was going to quit, and I was just going to get this thing out of my system. Huh. I was either going to die drinking or I was going to somehow, some way, God was going to help me get sober.
And what happened?
And what happened was that I just kept suffering and suffering and putting everybody around me through the same torture and suffering. And finally, in the year 2000, on April 23rd, which was the day I had my last drink, I was left I was in Napa. I was homeless.
Before homeless, what did you say?
I was in Napa, California.
Oh, okay.
I ended up somehow in Napa, California.
Okay.
And I was homeless, and I was like, I couldn't die. I was just like down to, a couple of hundred pounds, 100-something pounds.
Yeah.
I had nowhere to go. I was just so completely devastated and just I couldn't understand what happened to this kid who wanted to be a rock and roll star so many years ago. And finally, I gave up. That was my moment of grace. I was able to just say, because I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been around the rooms, and I had heard and I had seen the hope in the people's faces, and I had friends who had told me that if I did certain things that I could also live a better life and stop drinking. And so I just gave up. I just threw myself on my knees, and I asked this God to help me. And from that moment on, I haven't had a drink. I have not found it necessary to drink. I've been given the courage and the ability to go to meetings and to listen to what I need to listen to and to do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and to... I have to be honest with you, Drew. The truth of the matter is that somehow, some way, by giving up, I was able to get sober.
Wow.
I have absolutely no idea how this happens, other than I go to meetings every day. I've taken the suggestions that are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life is 200% different.
What was that last day before you surrendered? I guess that's probably a good word for this. Prior to the surrender, what was that like for you? Like just that last day drinking into the first day sober.
That
do you remember it?
Yes, I do. I'll never forget that last day. That night before, I had been putting everything in my body, trying to shut out the pain that was going on inside of my head and the shame and the guilt, and nothing was working. I wasn't getting drunk, and I wasn't getting high. And the noise in my head.
It just, you kept using and drinking?
I kept using.
And you couldn't get high?
I couldn't
get high at all?
I couldn't. I drank a whole bottle of some Cabernet. I was in the Napa Valley, so they had some good bottles of wine this girl had. I did a bunch of methamphetamines. I did a bunch of weed. I did everything. And that had been happening for years. It had been happening for years. And I couldn't shut the noise out.
It turned its back on you.
It did. It did. It certainly did. And it turned its back on me years and years prior. I couldn't see it because we're in such a haze. We just don't see it. And finally, the girl in the morning told me to get the hell out of the house because she lived on the grounds where she worked and her boss was coming. And I pedaled my bike, the bike that she had given me, into the downtown section of Napa. And I just looked back. While I was pedaling, I looked back at my life and I looked forward at the insanity I was headed for. And I wanted to kill myself. Mm. I actually wanted to, just jump in front of a bus. And something happened that I cried out and I asked for help. And something happened to me. I'm here today as a result of that cry.
That's amazing. How did Alcoholics Anonymous come into your life?
Alcoholics Anonymous came into my life throughout my whole life. I had heard about it. I had cousins who were in the program.
So you had some family who... Yeah. So you had a loose idea about what it was about?
I had an idea, and I had been to a rehab, and I had heard about it in jail, and, I knew friends. I just didn't think it was for me.
Yeah.
In spite of all the pain, all the suffering, and all the ups and downs, and all the craziness that I went through.
Right.
Alcohol is a very, very powerful foe. Mm. And it lied to me, and it told me that everything was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's it like today, man? Yeah, it seems like you look happy.
My life is a miracle. First of all, it's a miracle. I haven't had the desire to drink or to use since that day that I cried out for help. I'm what I always wanted to be. I wanted to be a man among men, a worker among workers, a useful person in society, to be loved and to be able to love. And today I have that in my life.
Once again, you're listening to America's 12-Step Radio Show. My name is Drew, and this is Stepping Out.